Today on our show, we're talking with Carol Michaels, who is a career coach and artist advocate, and also the author of How to Survive and Prosper as an Artist, Selling Yourself Without Selling Your Soul. Carol, thanks so much for being with us today.
A pleasure.
So, to begin with, the book you've written has been, I think, a handbook and a textbook for artists for quite a while. How is it that you came to write that particular book?
I had started working as a career coach in around 1978. In those years, the term career coach had not been invented, so I called myself an art marketing consultant. And I was looking around for material to recommend, reading material to recommend to clients. And at that point, the only book that was out was a book called The Artist's Guide to His Market. So, and it was very, very condescending and sort of treated artists as learning disabled adults. And so I came up with the idea
And being only one gender as well.
Right, right. So anyway, I came up with the idea of writing a book, and having had a hands-on relationship with the art world as I used to do public art and big installations, I really based it on my experience and kind of the do's and don'ts and school of hard knocks and those kinds of things.
Because you were and are an artist and a sculptor, and at that time were doing installations and gallery shows. So by speaking from experience, you were talking about your experience in the gallery world as well as in the realm of public art. Is that correct?
Right. I had, let's see, a career. By the time I started working as a career coach, I had abandoned my career. I retired from my career as an artist for a lot of reasons, because there were collaborative efforts, and it was going to the projects were so big, and it was getting to be 80% administrative and 20% creative, and I didn't like the ratio. I had originally started off wanting to be a writer, but anyway, got sidetracked and got involved in the art world. So, but I had an awful lot of experience. Then I think the kind of the part where I got really involved in advocacy work, which is very, very passionate to me, was I had married at 18, and my first husband was an artist, and he was painting, and we were so naive. He had given 150 paintings to a these were works on paper, to a gallery in Washington, D.C., in Georgetown. And long story short, she denied having the paintings, and we had to go to court. And the judge, she told the woman, the gallery owner told the judge that my husband had given her all of the 150 paintings as a birthday present. And the judge said, oh, okay, case dismissed, and the dealer got to keep the paintings. So that was really, really a huge growing up experience, because I really thought at that point, I was very young and thought, oh, the American judicial system would be really, really fair. So that was my first encounter with the necessity for using contracts, and also being very dubious of people who seem to offer a lot but give you very little.
Wow, that's really a stunning story. And that was your first experience, really, with the art.
Right,
that
my
was
very
your
first
husband.
Experience. And
because you were also making art at that time as well.
No, not at that point. My first husband was in school. I was supporting him, and I was working. So I didn't get involved until art until probably the late 60s, somewhere around there.
So you're. Maybe we should go on with the story of your husband then. So then your first husband, so then you began to help him navigate the art world a bit and manage contracts. Is that what happened?
He really didn't need it. I actually learned a lot from him. He was quite a marketeer, and he went to the Yale School of Architecture, Art and Architecture, and he was already, he really knew his way in terms of doing public relations. He was already being published when he was a student and sort of in the New York Times. So I can't say I really, really helped him. I helped him start a group called Ant Farm, which became sort of famous for, I guess the biggest project was Cadillac Ranch and the Cadillacs buried in the desert in Texas. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Sure, I am. It looks a little bit like Stonehenge and... Right. Only it's Cadillacs buried,
it's
Cadillac, right?
And with exactly.
Nose up, right, if I remember correctly.
Just to make a really long story short, but anyway, our projects were being published simultaneously with a European group called Haus Rucker, H-A-U-S, R-U-C-K-E-R, and they were based Vienna. And I grew weary of Ant Farm, changed gears, and left Ant Farm and went over to working with Haus Rucker. And then that was, we were then moved to Dusseldorf and then eventually New York City, had a big exhibition and really liked New York and wanted to stay and decided to try to make a go of it, which we did.
And had an exhibition meaning of not of Ant Farm, but of...
No, it was of Haus Rucker's work. It was a collaborative of visual artists, designers, and architects.
And tell me a little bit about that. So Haus Rucker was another person you were working with? That's
it was collaborative? Haus Rucker actually means house changers, house movers in German. So this was another group. At that point in 20th century art history, there was a lot of emphasis on groups working together. I think it was sort of modeled after the idea of rock bands. So it was a great experiment. Very few, there are few that survived. It was difficult because the collaboration amongst artists can be kind of weary, and a lot of egos come into play. But it was a good experiment, and we got a lot of things done, and did a lot of projects in the United States, all of which were temporary. This was the whole idea of just doing kind of installations that were not permanent. And then finally, we had one of the inaugural exhibitions at Centre Beaubourg in Paris, and then at that point, the New York group, it was split into two groups, one in Europe and one in New York, and the New York group disbanded. We decided to go our separate ways and scale down, and that was the point that I decided to switch gears, become a writer, and I didn't know how to support myself as a writer. I knew how to do it as an artist, and that's where I came up with the idea of doing the career coaching.
It's fascinating. So I want to talk about the career coaching, but I'd also like to ask you about Cadillac Ranch. If you were instrumental in having that done, how was that? How did that come about? Because that's a permanent project. I think it's a very powerful and, in my mind, seminal project. How did that come about, and how was that installed?
Okay. I can't take credit for that because by that point, when it was actually built, I had abandoned Ant Farm and was already in Europe. So I don't know the ins and outs of how it was accomplished and how Mr. Marsh got involved in it and that whole thing. When I was with Ant Farm, we were doing a lot of just kind of conceptual projects, drawings. Nothing was really, really being built. And then when I left, things got built.
Okay. So then we're moving forward to your artist advocacy work, and
yes.
And how did that begin? So you began with writing the book, or you were also helping artists in the meantime?
No, I came up with the idea, and I really had in mind only helping visual artists. I wrote a press release and I sent it out, and someone at the Village Voice thought what I was doing was really interesting, and so she did an article, and I was kind of unnerved because I was getting inundated with calls from not only visual artists but performing artists as well and writers, and I thought, oh my God, I'm out of my territory. So then I just said, okay, well, if I'm ineffective, I'll give them their money back. But then it was very, very clear that I saw artists, regardless of their performing arts or writers or visual artists, have a lot of the same kinds of issues and challenges. So there's always been sort of a ratio. I would say 80% of my clients are visual artists, and then the other 20% are amongst writers and performing artists.
Well, this is a good point. You say a lot of them have the same, or there are similar challenges between all those fields. What are the similarity, or what are the common challenges?
Well, I think it's maintaining perseverance, maintaining self-confidence, not letting rejection get in the way and just keep on going, trying to make yourself understood by the greater population, which can also be very, very frustrating. So those are a few of the similarities.
And do you also encounter much in general kind of fear or an inability for artists to take themselves as seriously as they should, or questions of quality? Is that also common?
Well, I'm glad you raised fear. Yes, there are a lot of fears and afraid, you know, fears of not feeling good enough, and that other people are getting from A to B quicker. The negative competitive edge, it can be kind of devastating. So let's see. I'm sorry. What was the other thing you mentioned? Fear
and insecurity, and you know what you really just articulated. But how do artists manage that? What is a way of managing those kind of very difficult situations?
Well, I've noticed there's a huge attrition rate because amongst clients, they get very excited and yes, I'm going to do this A, B, and C, and then they drop off. Or drop out, and the secret. I mean, it comes from within, and I haven't really been able to put my finger on it. Is just being able to, even though you doubt yourself, being able to keep on trucking and do what you want to do, and not let other people's opinions get in the way. So, and that's hard. Not everyone can do it, but that requires a great deal of strength. So I always say, you know, to people, the bad news is now more as the whole field of career development and the arts and all the books that have come out, like your books and my book and all the others. So artists are much more informed these days than they were when I first started doing my work as a career coach. So a lot more information is available. So the competition is very stiff. On the other hand, only a small percentage of artists really have the courage to stick it out. So artists will start off enthusiastic at the beginning, but when they really get into it and see what's involved, the dropout rate is very big.
That's very interesting. I think that's one of the most difficult areas. I know a professor once told me that she felt that artists had to be under a great delusion because you have to believe in your work when nobody else does, and there's really no evidence or reason to believe in it other than you believe it's good. And that's really very odd in a way. I mean, even as a writer, things can be more concrete. The writing either is readable at the very least or it's not. But with art, it's even more of an odd animal in a way, isn't it?
Yes, I agree, and it's also extremely subjective. And then you're also dealing with the art-buying public and then the general public, and I think I mentioned in my book that the public, which is very, very insecure about visual art, much better in terms of their convictions when it comes to literature, dance, music. And I give the example that if you interviewed man or woman on the street and said, what kind of music do you like? And they'd be forthcoming and say, well, jazz, rhythm and blues, opera, et cetera, et cetera. And that would be very easy for them to answer. But if you say, what kind of art do you like? They really, really, really get intimidated and kind of very, very puzzled. So that's another factor that makes it very, very difficult.
And how has the landscape, do you think, changed? I mean, you've revised your book several times, and how is in that period of time, how do you see the struggle for artists changing in terms of your clients? Are there newer questions that are happening now, or is it really the same issues that keep coming up?
It's the same issues. On the bright side, what I have to say is the whole field in terms of information for artists has evolved. When I first started doing what I'm doing, people considered me a witch. You weren't allowed to talk about art and money. It was totally uncool. There were all of these kind of unwritten rules and regulations. There was a whole kind of list of things that where artists would be accused of selling out. That sort of no longer exists. It's kind of a real fait accompli. So the landscape in terms of information for artists, and that it's not awful to ask for help. It's not awful to talk about art and marketing, which were like forbidden words. And I can go through a litany of, let's say, organizations, including many in New York, that absolutely turned away when they found out what I was doing. So, and now they're all they're all very, very involved in art marketing programs and education programs for artists, and I think it's terrific. The same applies to colleges and universities. Very, 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 I don't even know if any of them were offering, let's say, art marketing career development courses when I first started out. So, and that was very, very important to me.
I think some of the universities still have a little ways to go. I know that Yale still doesn't offer anything in terms of professional development, and that still is considered a topic that's almost unapproachable there.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Brown does. There are Ivy League schools that do, but
right.
Yale still doesn't, and it's not considered. It's still very much in the mythology that you're talking about. That's decades old.
I was going to say when I lived in Manhattan, because I was on the an advisory board at FIT, and at that point, because I was really lobbying hard to get, they had established a four-year visual arts program, BFA, and I really lobbied hard to get a mandatory career development course going, and it happened. And at that point, and I don't know whether things have changed, whether any of the schools at colleges and universities in New York have a mandatory course, but I'm kind of out of that scene right now, so I'm not sure. But it was hard work. It really, really was hard work.
Right, and you really paved the way for so many other people that teach, I think, professional development courses as well, because that was, you were really convincing these schools that this is important and needed, obviously, for the artists' careers. Is that correct?
Yes, and I was fighting an uphill battle, which I'm sure some of the issues still exist today, where faculty members didn't want students to have too much information because they saw them as a possible threat once they graduated from school, because they'd be competing for the same galleries and museums, et cetera, collectors, et cetera, as they are. So that was one sort of negative. And then the other was kind of an old-fashioned idea, which I understand to a certain extent, that, you know, the world is tough enough as it is, and students shouldn't be subjected to real-life issues while they're in school, and they should just work in their studio and paint and sculpt and da-da-da-da-da-da.
That's very interesting. I think I've heard more recently about specifically the issue of, which doesn't seem to have died out completely, professors feeling that they're competing with their students. I read a blog entry of one woman who's an artist getting an MFA at Columbia, I think it was, and she said she was always the darling of the class. Teacher liked her, although other people in the class didn't like the teacher at all, thought she gave horrible withering crits. But she said when it came time to her asking for a recommendation from that teacher for a particular grant, the professor said to her very clearly, I'm not going to give that to you because I'm also applying for that, and there's only so many spaces in this
mm-hmm.
world for artists.
Right.
And I mean, and she was stunned and shocked and just couldn't stop writing about how, you know, this is what she's paying a lot of money for as
right.
well. And,
but it's a good, you know, it's a growing up experience. You know, it sort of shows, you know, what's out there. I mean, I find it very, very unusual for artists to help other artists. I mean, when it comes to sharing information about materials or something like that, which is totally non-threatening, but you know, an artist picking up the phone who's with, let's say, a gallery and saying, "This, you really need to meet this person because their work is just super," that is so rare, really, really rare.
And that seems unfortunate because, I mean, so many people also talk about getting together as a group, that when artists help one another, they seem to get furthest. I recently interviewed John Curran, who was a graduate of Yale, and he talked about, you know, being a house painter and having a terrible time, and then deciding he was going to get together with six of his friends, which he did, and they all met once a week and decided, we're going to help each other. If we find a curator, or if we find something, we'll tell each other about it. And that setup seems to be something that's very helpful, and at the same time is difficult for artists to arrange for themselves.
Yes, yes. Well, it's kind of, I think, a personal philosophic view. If you see, let's say, the world very, very small, and there are only limited possibilities. So there, I mean, therefore, you're fighting tooth and nail to eliminate all the competition. But if you see the world in a much broader way, and then the huge benefits on lots of different levels for sharing information, cooperating, and being supportive, I think it's great. I think it's really, really great. But it's rare. It's really rare. So we have a lot of work to do in that area.
I think so, because I also wonder, how do artists put together groups? I mean, John Curran had his friends from Yale, but also how do artists go out there and just find friends or put together a group? How do they get support? Is kind of a difficult question to answer, isn't it?
Well, it takes a lot of people in the group having the self-confidence to not feel threatened by other artists. And so it would take, and I don't think it's impossible, but it takes a special group of people to be able to do that. I see the failures where there's good intentions at the beginning, but as soon as one of the artist's career starts to kind of go up the ladder quicker than the other, then all of a sudden the sort of negative kind of awful feedback comes in. And this, I see this also, too, when artists start off and they're kind of in a group and then they're all selling work for the same price, and then one person, let's say a client of mine, I get them to raise their prices, and then the other artists are very, very intimidated by this and, oh, how could you do this, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of pettiness involved, but I'm still an optimist. And I think it's possible to maintain a group like that for a long time.
Well, maybe is it helpful if there are different people in the group? I once knew a woman who was working with a group. I don't know what the name of the group is, but it was the name of the group was, I forgot what it was exactly. But what they did was, there was a writer, there was an artist, there were people there was an entrepreneur. There were several people in the group helping each other. But only one of them was an artist.
Yes, no, that could be very good. On the other hand, I've seen one of my clients was signed up for a small business administration kind of career development course, but it was also people from a lot of different occupations. And I ended up having to have a long chat with the person who was running the course, because the information she was imparting was just not applicable to the visual art world. So, because the visual art world is pretty strange in a lot of ways, and there's just things that you can't, that are effective, and other things that are ineffective and don't work. So, but more back to your point of a group that is made up of people from lots of different occupations. I think that's a good idea, really a good idea.
And in today's world, for artists, you know, with now there's an enormous amount of people coming out of graduate school and art schools everywhere. Is there something that you feel that they should know? I mean, besides picking up your book or learning more from you, is there anything in particular that you think they should keep in mind?
Well, the strength of it is really psychological factors of abandoning fears of failure and believing in yourself. And you know, visual art's a lonely profession because you're in the studio by yourself for hours and hours, and being able to develop that stamina of working in isolation. So it's, and I also think it's really good to develop friendships back to people in other occupations and not just stick to people, you know, fellow artists, because it can certainly expand your horizon and worldview of things.
And I know we discussed this earlier, but do you have any other tips or ideas for how artists can overcome the daunting fears that I think you just touched upon, which is, you know, the ability to stick with it, the ability to believe in what you're doing, you know, when you've just left school and you've had, you know, a series of withering critiques and are very unsure about your place in the world? How is it that one stays optimistic and positive about their work, or at least is there any tools that you could recommend to battle the kind of insecurities that will enter?
Therapy might help. I really, really don't know what to say. I just see based on all of the artists that I've worked with, some people just have that innate ability. And actually, I will say something that that I really enjoy working with people who are kind of in the empty nest syndrome. Let's say they went to art school, got married, put their career on hold, raised children, and now the kids are out of the house. That has helped greatly with being more secure and more feisty and having that feeling in a very good way of surviving as an artist, because just the way all of the life experiences they've had can be funneled into their career as an artist, and that can be extremely helpful. Or someone who's just coming out of school and hasn't had all of the, let's say, life experiences will be much more vulnerable to what other people are thinking, et cetera, et cetera. So sometimes it's just you have to wait and be patient and have a lot of life experiences behind you in order to keep on going.
Thank you. That's very helpful. It's been wonderful to talk with you today. There's, you know, students as well as the art public listening to this show. Is there anything you want to say in closing to the people who are listening?
I think because we hit on the whole issue of stamina and believing in yourself, and that can certainly be applied to all occupations. It's not just the visual arts, but I do find the need for validation. If we can eliminate that, of course, there's always a need, and it's great to get feedback. But if we can eliminate that need for validation, where it becomes sort of obsessive, I think that will certainly help with, you know, surviving and having a good career as an artist.
Carol, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.